Because any kind of vessel, if it's non-utilitarian, suddenly might be called sculpture, and then it's called clay sculpture, and then there's this kind of this controversy of just what is pottery and what's clay sculpture. And anyway, so today I'm going to talk about the beauty of function, whatever that might mean, because just about everything has a function. A painting on the wall has a function of being a beautiful object and an object of inspiration. Or I don't have, these are all pottery slides, but I could have shown a whole series of slides of, say, a 747, the function and the beauty of it being able to carry a heavy load and fly through the air, or a rocket, a spaceship, a boat, all kinds of functional objects, a bicycle, automobile. I'm going to deal with pottery forms and try to talk a little bit about the function they serve. And I think most important is that people can learn to read pottery and be able to better appreciate what makes a good form and what makes a not as good form. And if people could only learn to appreciate pottery more, maybe use it more in their daily life, that would be better for everyone. When it comes to function, we see in eating and drinking, we seem to prefer or use plastic and paper and disposable objects, which is a trend that needs to be curbed and needs to be reversed back to the tradition of using and eating out of pottery dishes. So I'm going to just show a few more historical slides of some beautiful, what I feel are beautiful examples of functional pottery forms that could be used for a variety of reasons. And this is obviously some sort of a bowl shaped, beautiful duck form. It almost has a whimsical feel to it. It almost looks like it could just become animated and actually swim. Sort of a vessel shape, boat shape, or bird shape. It would probably float in water. Here's some large storage jars. Throughout history, pottery has been used a great deal for storage containers. These are from the island of Crete, the temple, the Knossos temple fortress on the island of Crete. These were large, huge storage jars used for the nobility there, and they are very elaborately decorated. These are some 5 or 6 feet in height, huge pottery vessels. And throughout history, pottery has been used to make vessel forms for storage or eating and drinking out of. These are some rather mundane Egyptian cooking vessels or cooking pots or storage, grain storage jars. Most Egyptian art seems to be non-pottery, either wood or carved stone. Alabaster was very popular, gold and silver objects. So we tend to overlook pottery that was made in Egypt. And this is some very, very humble, probably used for everyday eating and drinking or storage. Earthenware, low temperature clay could be placed directly over an open fire. And because of its low fire, non-vitrified quality, it could withstand the heating and expansion and contraction of being directly over a fire. These pieces are decorated because they are fired upside down in a bonfire method, and the rims, being down in the ashes and coals, tend to be reduced and turn this black color, while the bottom parts here were further away from the flames and tend to oxidize as the fire died down. So that's what gives them their decoration. A very crude Neolithic mug. And in this piece, I wanted to mention something about memory traces that people have. As mentioned in Phil Rossen's book, Ceramics, that we all have various different memories from growing up, perhaps even from before our birth. Memories and textures and smells and things that might, for each person, evoke a totally different memory. And so memory traces are what he talks about in pottery. The texture of this perhaps reminds somebody maybe of a pine cone or tree bark, or maybe the color of the brown, maybe a kind of a drink, or rocks, rotting leaves, such a variety of different things that could be evoked for different people for different reasons. And all of pottery is like that. Either the color, the texture, implied texture, or patterning will, for everybody, evoke different memory traces. And this piece, for me, is very, I love the texture of this. It's sort of like maybe carved leather, maybe tire tracks, lots of different things that it tends to evoke. I just want to be able to touch and hold this piece. Lovely piece, probably 6,000 years old. Very humble jug form that we got in North Africa. It's very simple, it's very easy to understand what this is all about. We as human beings, we need to carry things around. It has a handle that kind of invites you to pick it up. It holds its contents very well in the belly of the form, and then it has a narrow neck that would kind of direct the contents as it was tipped, contents being poured out. Pottery forms are often referred to. We talk about the foot, the belly, the neck, the shoulder, the lip. So many human terms or biological terms maybe are used to describe pottery. And unfortunately, there are very few adjectives used to pronounce words that are used to describe pottery. Pottery people are usually not as articulate, probably. I enjoy looking at things. Not always able to describe all of their unseen beauties. And a lot of it is, there just aren't words to describe sometimes. This vase kind of maybe looks like a bird form. It has breasts, actually, so who knows what kind of a creature this might evoke. And it has this barley painted on the side, so perhaps it carried wine or beer or some sort of a drink, and in its kind of whimsical manner it would be fun to be served out of a container such as this. These pots we see so much in museums, and it took me the longest time to figure out why they had such pointy bottoms, because they were certainly impractical to try to stand up on a hard floor. And these are Greek merchant vessels actually that would be carried on merchant ships throughout the Mediterranean, and this shape would enable the vessels to interlock very nice and tightly on board of a ship, so they would nestle, interlock, and they wouldn't roll around as they were being carried on board ship. Also, they usually had sand floors, and they could be easily nestled into a sand floor and wouldn't tip over. Their contents, no doubt, very, very precious. And so the form actually seeming to us to be very precarious. It was very secure on board a ship. A variety of different kinds of handles. So often, a very important feature of pottery that's meant to contain things, the handles here. These were probably very, very heavy containers full of olive oil or whatever liquid, and pulled from the hull of ships on ropes, or maybe two men together. So they needed very, very strong handles in such a way that it would not tip over easily. Different kinds of shapes that might interlock and be most efficient use of the space on board of a ship. Here's a Greek, it's called a kylix. So wine drinking cup. We drink wine out of a wine goblet, a glass wine goblet. But these shapes are very low, it's almost like a frisbee shape with two handles on the sides. The beauty, and it's a footed bowl, so we're looking directly down on this piece. But to imagine drinking the wine and being able to see through the clear liquid at a form beneath the wine, and then tipping up and revealing the form. And then there was a game that was played where they would fling these and toss these and crash them after they were used at special parties. So it's sort of a gaming object, but beautiful shapes. This is a Tang Dynasty storage jar, and this one, try to imagine some of these, what they might be used for. Can you imagine a nice flour ground grain inside of this and using that and dipping into side of it? Storage jars were very, very important. Now it's almost a lost item. We sort of have our token storage jars maybe on the kitchen counter, but in these days everything was kept in some sort of a pottery container. Every clothes and all foodstuffs, special things that you didn't want bugs or rodents to attack. So pottery jars were very, very important objects. Also, when they didn't have so much, what can I say, we were just bombarded with color from television and printed material, magazines, everything that in these days, just a colorful pottery jar may have been one of the few beautiful objects for them to be inspired by, especially desert people with very little to look at. Sometimes pottery objects were what was the one thing that inspired them or contrasted to their arid environment. This is about a 9th century AD, five dynasties, it's just before the Song Dynasty in China, burial urn. And at first you might kind of wonder what this object might be used for, but when you start to understand that it's a burial urn, perhaps, and the significance of the container shape, and yet there's a very special container at the top, perhaps the bird, maybe to fly the spirit off into the next life. Who knows? It's very difficult. You can only kind of surmise what you think that the piece means. But a beautiful shape, and here again, very easy to see the foot, the belly, the hip, the foot, the hip, maybe the belly, the neck, the head even, maybe the rim or the top parts that might relate to a human form. As you probably are aware of, tea drinking, the tea ceremony in the Orient has long been a very important tradition. In the tea ceremony, even today, some of these tea bowls, such as this, or things, small tea bowls, handheld bowls, might be worth thousands of dollars. So people would pay enormous amounts of money for just the perfect bowl to entertain guests. And they'd have special friends over and bring out the very finest pottery pieces for the tea ceremony. That was the most important or very important form of entertaining your guests. Anyway, this very elaborately decorated but very delicately decorated tea bowl. Imagine drinking a light colored tea and holding this warm in your hands, the beautiful glaze, and then the foot being unglazed, kind of revealing the inner structure, the bones of the clay, and the contrast between the crudeness of the foot, the richness, the depth, the flowery, floral glazed surface, and then try to almost instills a sense of taste or enhances the flavor of the tea that might be contained. A very strange object. This is a tilo. Song Dynasty is about 9th century AD in China. Legend has, or stories have, that the Chinese would take maybe a 10 or 15 minute nap or rest their head on this. These shapes, there are lots of pillows made ceramic, and there's a point in the back of your skull called the pillow point, which if you apply pressure to it, will tend to relieve stress or whatever ails you. So here is this bear tethered, a tethered bear, and kind of symbolizes maybe the release of this bear within. Some more Song Dynasty. A lot of these were tea storage for leaf tea storage jars that were exported, and so they would export this valuable commodity in these very beautiful jars, which kind of would tend to advertise or for export to kind of embellish the contents within. This is carved in the shape of a lotus flower, kind of reminiscent of that. The Sun Dynasty, these are, again, about 9th century to 11th century AD. Some thought by scholars to be some of the finest pots ever made. They're, when they were made is very important. Then the perfection that they have, the precision that they have, the thinness, the sound is a quality that Americans don't realize. We can't see pots. They're in museums. They're behind glass cases. We never are able to touch and feel and handle pottery, it seems. But some of these, the sound quality was also very, very important quality to the Oriental people. It still is today. The sounds of some of these, even after 1,000 years, is just like music. In contrasting the Song Dynasty, at just about the same time in Japan, the Japanese were kind of trying to be very, very different. They were tired of this perfect symmetry and trying to begin their own style, which was still is today, to have natural forms, forms that almost seem not to be made by human hands. And so we have these these tabo pots that were made really by farming people, very farmers, and then during their off times they would make pottery for also for tea storage, and some for various other. Kimchi was one that the Koreans would use pottery jars for pickling or whatever, but these are almost intentionally made asymmetrical like this. A beautiful example of wood firing too, that of course all the pots at this time were fired in wood burning kilns, but here they've allowed the wood ash to collect the deposit and form its own natural glazing effect. So we have in this almost looks like a rock in a stream perhaps. So there's a lot of beauty in this crudeness, which is a very important Japanese aesthetic. This kind of showing the throwing lines is something that's not new at all, although it seems like contemporary potters tend to do this, but it's something that the Japanese had been doing nearly 1,000 years ago. I want to show a series of tea bowls. These are Japanese takumori tea bowls, about probably the 14th to 16th century. And here again, kind of contrasting from the refined precision of the Song Dynasty and the Ming Dynasty, which was happening in China, this perfection of clean white porcelain clay. Here the Japanese people are using almost intentionally very crude and coarse clay bodies. And that enriching the tea ceremony, the feeling of this clay, you can almost imagine the feel of it with these kind of quartz and feldspathic rocks kind of pushing it through the clay. Very humble forms, and yet some of these are today national treasure. They're priceless or worth hundreds of thousands of dollars for these tiny little tea balls. So very simply made. This bending lip is almost intentional, and in fact some of the shoguns who were in charge of different regions at the time in Japan would diagram and draw out specific shapes that potters were to make, and some of these, although seemingly so spontaneous, they would fire kiln loads of pots that were trying to achieve this one certain perfection that the nobility, the shoguns or the rulers were attempting to achieve. And this is the area here of Shino. We use glazes today that are sometimes called carbon fiber Shino glazes. And this Shino glaze is, for generations, was this kind of a thick, kind of pasty white, sometimes brownish glaze, which tended to crawl like this. And by feeling it, though, it gives a wonderful warm feeling, almost of a skin. So it kind of reminds you of skin on the form, sort of like the skin on the body. It's glazes are, at best, would resemble more of a skin on the form and enhance the form within. Here you can see the finger marks from the glazing when it was dipped. And in all handmade pottery, you can kind of tell the story of how it was made. And if you look closely, you begin to see these things that happen. Some of these, I showed a slide yesterday of an Egyptian piece that was repaired with gold, and this one you can see again has been broken and repaired with gold, which only more enhances its value and its its existence, I guess. This piece seeming today, if I was to pull this one out of the kiln, I'd think, well, it kind of slumped or something was wrong with it. But on second glance, or the more you kind of become to know this pot, it's a very beautiful pot that kind of tells a lot about its calmness, its informality, its humbleness. And yet, because the gold is in the piece, then that contrasts and makes it a very precious piece. These wide bowls that are wide topped are meant for the summer months, the summer tea, so the tea would cool more quickly, where the bowls that are narrower would be for winter when it would cool more quickly and try to hold the heat in longer. So they had seasonal tea bowls as well. And this bowl has kind of this mysterious cut in the foot, which some people try to describe as it has something to do with releasing the spirit. But if you've ever washed dishes and you turn it, you wash it, turn it upside down, and a foot like this would hold this water in it. So this cut probably was to just allow the water to not collect in the inverted foot. And here also you have kind of this glaze dripping down, which kind of it enhances the flavor of the tea, perhaps. Some of these bowls, too, you know, how the bowl first came to existence, I don't know, man probably used gourds, even his hands, you know, to first get a drink of water. It's very natural to take your hands, grab your hands together, to dip in and drink or even eat out of. And the bowl form is just a natural human form, universal form throughout the world. It's not like some great invention, but try to imagine each bowl. What if there was never a bowl made and somebody made a bowl form? It would probably be one of the most beautiful sculptural objects that you could make in its simplicity. The inside, totally a different surface and shape than the outside. This is an Arebe piece about 16th century Japan. Kind of a bowl shape, but how the simplicity of this handle, twisted handle, kind of accentuates this landscape that's happening. There's kind of a field, there's flowers, some birds flying, just that simplicity, and then the handle kind of bridging over the top. Sometimes there's a great deal of beauty in the simplest things. I showed a few of these memories bowls yesterday. I just wanted to show a few more. Let's see. My story's upside down. That last one was kind of showing these a lot for pottery type people because we need to see as much as we can and see what's been done and know why it's been done maybe and then go on from that to and justify why we're still doing it. So, this little bowl, I love this. These bugs on here, locusts or whatever they are, they just kind of create this buzzing sound for me. These are Mimbri's bowls again, about the 11th century AD. Again, this one has a hole broken into it, as I mentioned yesterday. These were objects that were actually presented to child when they were going through their growing up rites, probably in their early teens or puberty, and they were kept throughout their life, and then when they died, this bowl was buried with them over their skull in the floor of the home, and people were buried in the home dwelling, and then during the ceremony they would break the hole in the bottom of the bowl, which would then allow the spirit to escape. So perhaps these bowls had some significance to their name or something about the person that was to keep them. A large storage jar. The function of this to hold grain, most likely, in its rounded bottom, which could be tipped over or just kind of rocked over easily to get the grain, the beans or corn, whatever might be in there. It'd be much easier than trying to pick it up and tip it over. But form and function, it's a beautiful swelling form. It's the least amount of surface area to contain very securely the contents within. Well, that was actually kind of almost a contemporary, so late 1800s Pueblo pottery from southwestern New Mexico.
How tall is it?
It's pretty deceiving. I like the slide, but it is so deceiving. That's just some sagebrush or some bush, but it's probably, I don't know the exact dimensions, but it's probably maybe 24 to 30 inches tall. It's very, very large, but this picture makes it look like it's huge, bigger than life size. I kind of like to show that. I showed some early American crocks and jugs yesterday, and these were purely functional. These were when people start to move westward and settle in the United States, and pioneer people, they needed something that was going to last. They didn't have much room for all this extra frivolous decorative stuff. So at most of these pots are very, very heavy, durable, and then some very delicate, subdued or reserved decoration. Cobalt forming the blue was rather an expensive import from Europe, and so they used it sparingly. This was probably made in New York, and after several firings in a kiln, as it became old, the cobalt would tend to fume and create this kind of bluish-gray color. And this has kind of a Dutch influence, that the flowers coming from Dutch potters that had been colonizing the United States. This is probably early 1800s, maybe. This is about 1820s, perhaps. I like these very heavy rims. These pots were usually fired rim to rim, foot to foot, stacked up in kiln, maybe 10 or 12 high. So part of their thickness and the way they were made was also to enable them to fire without kiln shells. They didn't use kiln shells. So it had a lot to do with how they were fired and how they were made and what they were going to be used for. As again, these pottery jars were a very important appliance in a pioneer's kitchen, probably as important now as then as a refrigerator might be now. They were storage vessels, and they needed these pottery forms to pickle meat or store salted meats, prepare foods. They had very few items and objects, and the pottery crock was usually a very, very important. I showed this one yesterday. This is a 3 gallon. Usually they add a number on for how many gallons they would contain. Beautiful swelling form. It almost has a sort of a chubby man character, a human sort of quality. And pots often do take on sort of humanistic qualities. You can imagine certain kinds of characters, which may again relate to your memory traces of people you've met or characters you've met. Picture form, I know if you show a few picture forms. Again, the early American pots were very, very heavy and thick, and so that if you tipped them over, they may chip, but usually didn't break. I like that quality about them too, that they're gonna last for a long, long, long time, and compared to sometimes contemporary potters are making these very, very thin pots, and they probably won't last nearly as long as some of these heavy-duty pots. So it's influenced my work a lot to make pots heavier. I used to make them as light as I could, and I thought the lighter they were, the better they were. But now I sort of kind of middle of the road. You can't weigh art, and just because it's heavy doesn't mean it's not good. And that's a quality that often people will go and to a craft fair and they'll look at these pots, and if they're heavy, they kind of weigh out, this person must not know what they're doing. And if they're real light, maybe this person's really good. That's not always the case. It's just a very simple jugs. Probably you can imagine a nice fresh milk we can pour out of here, or lemonade, or iced tea, or something. Kind of bizarre. This is a Bennington pottery. started making art pottery in the late 1800s, and this is a Bennington milk jug from the late 1800s, and it has a kind of a hunting cabin sort of scene or motif here. You've got deer of the fresh hunt hung up, and maybe a wolf is peering into the picture. A bizarre sort of decorated picture. There's some contemporary pitchers and jugs that are very much trying to recapture the folk traditions of the past, and a lot of potters are trying to get back to this humble kind of quality, and this is has that quality. This is a Jeff Aistrich picture. You can still sort of see very subtle the throwing lines, which in this day and age, with most of our pottery being machine-made, the throwing line kind of symbolizes the fact that it's handmade. In the past, the potters would try to rib all that out because it didn't make any difference, but now we almost intentionally will leave throwing lines in our work to just make the user sure that it was handmade. And it gives a uniqueness and a humanistic quality, because so much of the pottery that we buy in stores has that machine, mindless sort of non-human quality, and although sometimes it's very precise and fine, still I enjoy that handmade quality. And pieces like this can become old friends after a long time of use, whereas very rarely do you have a machine-made piece become something that if it breaks, you just kind of, well, discard it and don't think so much about it. Handmade pots, you can almost imagine the friends, you know, if you have, you know the potter, you use even a coffee mug every day, you can almost like have a visit. It's almost as if they're present because you have these handmade objects. This pitchers are a beautiful functional form. They're of course meant to pour, so usually the rims are bent to direct the contents. Has a belly that would hold the liquid. Kind of the liquid doesn't spill out easily. The colors here, maybe this instills more of an iced tea, perhaps. Maybe lemonade, but not a hot drink, probably a cold drink. These vertical lines kind of give a fluidity to the contents that might be within as well. Form and function, to me, I used to be more concerned that things had to be just so, proportions had to be just right, handles had to be just right, and sometimes I like to break the rules, and just about everything can function. Some things are more beautiful than others, and some people prefer different kinds of objects. This one, to me, doesn't have enough shapeliness. It's a very masculine sort of shape, whereas some of these other forms will be perhaps more feminine. The bowl form, again, some contemporary bowl forms, a beautiful form that you could spend your whole life just making bowls, and indeed some potters do. This is by Otto Nossler. This, I want to start talking about some of the aesthetic design qualities that these have. This one, the outside kind of turning back in slightly to encompass and contain the interior shape. This form it's a beautiful, perfect form for containing a liquid, fluid form, or fluid content, maybe either, you know, soup perhaps not going to be used because of this glaze, a soup, or just symbolically containing, being able to contain like a fence might hold in cattle. These lines then of the profile of the bowl then turn back in and join and meet, so there is a closure to this sort of form where it tends to curve back in on itself. I like this very thin little foot that this rests on, and it kind of makes the crater glaze seem more spectacular. If it had a wide base on it, it just wouldn't show off this glaze as nicely. So here we got beautiful contrast of this shape that you have to kind of look through this crater glaze to see this beautiful, perfect shape. Anyway, this kind of bowl, he turns back in and kind of has a closure. It contains and encompasses the inside. With this bowl, the lines go out into infinity. They just continue into space. And it's, the insides then kind of can spill out and continue outward. This bowl by Richard Hunt, William Hunt, is, again, really not meant to be used, but this is a kind of pottery. They're kind of bowls about bowls. Probably had some sort of material in it that when it was fired, it burned out and left these little holes and voids. So it's probably very lightweight, frothy kind of lightweight, rather than a heavy, usable bowl. Here the rim, perhaps, on this bowl, the kind of horizontal rim kind of becomes a handle that you might pass this bowl and become more of a serving bowl. The next person could grab a hold of the rim and be very easy to serve with this kind of bowl. The rim becomes very decorative, and these lines kind of point inward but also extend outward. Creates a nice plane with these lines. Decorative lines. I love this bowl. It's actually an old bowl. You can see maybe on the rim some gold that's been to repair a chip or whatever. This one has an S-shaped curve from the foot, comes up as if it was going to close on itself, but then takes a turn back outward, which kind of gracefully delivers or opens the inside of the bowl to the user. Also, the fishnet sort of decoration here, very simple zigzagging line, becomes a fishnet and just beautifully encompasses the bowl and holds it together. It's a contemporary bowl by Ken Ferguson, and this is the total opposite of the very thin, small, refined foot, the elegant foot. This is just totally the opposite. Very sturdy bowl. There's no way this is going to tip over. Very crude, but yet the rim is kind of playful. I don't know exactly where this fits into function. It's probably, most people wouldn't think this is very functional, but indeed it does have a function as perhaps a centerpiece, or just the fact that you don't have to worry about it tipping over. It has a kind of an informality to it, and yet it has an elegance to it.
It looks like a spittoon.
It is spittoon. It could be elevated in the middle of a table, centerpiece of a table, screwed in, and you don't have to worry about it tipping over.
So you can turn it upside down and use it the other way too.
Yeah, you can do it that way. Another one by this guy's name is Stanley. Again, a wide-footed bowl. So there are all these things that I was taught as a potter. You had to have certain dimensions to the feet, and you had to have this dimension of diameter to rim and height and all these things. And it really doesn't make that much difference. You can do whatever you want to do, depending on the circumstance. This is sort of a party bowl. I just kind of have a gay feeling about this piece. And if there's any chips or punch or something in this bowl, I like it. It's kind of real fun. The decoration is really kind of meaningless and just kind of floats off of the piece. You know, taking the bowl, kind of symbolic bowl here, kind of trying to create an illusion of an elevated bowl, maybe becoming more spiritual because of its elevated position. Here, using the bowl, this is a Wayne Higby, a beautiful example of. If you're ever decorating pottery in a bowl form, you've got the inside shape, which is a concave surface. Very difficult to decorate because of that, the way it comes, the lines come together in the middle. And the outside just hops of that great deal of surface area, convex surface. But here, the wonderful play of the inside and outside of this landscape. And as you walk around the bowl, the landscape is constantly changing. You can almost can't distinguish at times where the rim is, which is a wonderful thing, but so often the rim kind of chops the inside separates the inside from the outside. I enjoy his work very, very much. This kind of bowl is kind of an inner self, inner being kind of bowl. This gal's kind of, her hair is kind of, it goes around to form the walls of the bowl, and she's kind of within herself, withdrawn perhaps. Herself. And that kind of the bowl is like that, a vessel with you in the interior space of a vessel form. And maybe that even unconsciously people may think that about a bowl. This is looking directly down, bird's eye view at a Song Dynasty bowl. This is 1,000 years old, and one thing about this is how hard and durable this glaze is to not be scratched or eroded at all. But that those people in the Song Dynasty had enormous control, technical skills of glazing and firing. And this just looks like a gemstone of some sort. Beautiful oil spot glaze.
Is that random then?
It's probably random. I don't know. Could have been applied. Splattered one material on top of another. It's just called oil spot. It's hard to say. A lot of glazes, fired glazes, stoneware glazes, have the same characteristics sometimes of precious gemstones. Sort of synthesized or synthetic gemstones in a way sometimes. And maybe I show this one just got on the flag outside with the earth. You know, is it a vessel? And sometimes this could almost look as if you were looking inside a bowl, perhaps. I don't often get very philosophical, but you know, the earth as a vessel, it's both a sphere, and yet looking at it from this vantage point, it becomes kind of a vessel form and pulls everything into it. And how small and precious it is, and how maybe it relates to that round quality of the potter's wheel, the circle. And moving on to some cover jars, storage jars. Potters today making cover jars for more of decorative, outside decorative surface treatment. Very seldom do we really use pottery jars that are made. This one. Wood ash glaze kind of drips and evokes maybe a sense of some liquid that might be contained. This is a Ken Ferguson. Perhaps sometimes I see kind of a forest of trees as I look at this too. Perhaps you can see kind of this horizon line and the drips of the glaze becoming trees. And this is all one glaze applied, and then because of the firing it kind of gets these trickles and runs and drips. This is by Robert Turner. It's kind of almost if you weren't sure who made it and when it was made, you might think it was some sort of ceremonial purpose that it might have had in some past tribe. And potters today often are making these kind of ceremonial objects for themselves, which in the slides I showed yesterday, the historical pottery slides, that often those were pots of a cultural religion, and now it seems we all have our own personal sort of feelings and spirituality, and often the potters, each one will come up with different solutions, and maybe someday archaeologists are going to try and put it all together and think that we believe in certain things. But anyway, this is his decoration was this tic-tac-toe sort of grid with little buttons, and he hit it on nearly everything but the jar, and just wonder what might be contained within a jar, such as this elevated on its beat. This person has really inspired me a lot. Don Pilcher used to teach at Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois. You have to look through all this clutter to see the jar within. It's a very beautiful feminine form beneath all of this clutter, but you know, we try to wonder what artists are going to say. Maybe they really are saying a lot about what we're doing to our earth and our environment and all the clutter that we have to live with. And perhaps this piece speaks about that. And you can still see the beauty within, but you have to look real carefully. This is by Warren McKenzie, an American folk potter. He just retired from the University of Minnesota, and this kind of looks to me like a faceted piece of obsidian, perhaps. Very earthy, real humble sort of cover jar. It's very small. Doesn't need a knob because it's small enough you can just wrap your fingers around it and lift off the top porcelain. Some more jars about the same scale where they don't need to have knobs to grab a hold of. Good examples of salt glazed ware that unglazed prior to the firing, and the incised lines were enhanced by this salt paper glazing. By Marguerite Wildenheim, and this really has a character. It just looks like somebody in their suit coat, they've got their arms up, and they're just ready to go out and conquer the world. So that Chris Gustin. This kind of tells, it seems to me, kind of a struggle from within. You can just imagine there must be a fight or something going on inside, and all this pushing out and poking. Perhaps a baby in a womb, or, you know, different people see different things that might be happening here. There's kind of this battle pushing in from the outside and pushing out from the inside in this container. Again, more of a decorative container, you could certainly probably use it, but so often, again, these cover jars are more decorative than anything. A couple very, very crude sorts of jars. This almost looks like just one big block of clay that's kind of cut off, squared off, in a top sort of fashion. So this gets down to the bare basics of what a cover jar might be. Just a top on a vessel form, then it becomes a covered jar. Very, very crude, in kind of a trend towards showing the material, the clay. For years, people have covered up the clay with shiny, shiny glazes, and now there seems to be a trend of the more our technology continues to grow, and it's computers and electronics, all the things are, the more technology seems to progress, the artists seem to move in the opposite direction, back to the earth, back to more primitive sorts of styles. This one takes you right back to the tea bowls I showed from Japan that are 400 or 500 years old, almost the same clay. They've intentionally added feldspathic rock to the clay to kind of season the clay and really make it look like the earth crudeness. And a lot of these, there's been a lot of influx of Japanese inspiration, and even now we're very, very close with the Japanese in many, many ways. And there have been many aesthetics that have come from the Japanese that now potters are starting to impart into their work. Michael Simon. This kind of looks like a granary of some sort. Small corn crib or something. Kim Ferguson jar. This is just kind of, just kind of sloppy. Maybe that's kind of the way some people are. Kind of trashy in a way. It has its own quiet beauty, but tells a lot about where we're heading and what we're doing. So it's a graceful sort of handle it, and it comes over these basket forms. It's another form. Could be explored. Pottery forms. That's another little baking dish. Just kind of the decoration here, the form and everything, it just kind of enhances the eating experience, I guess, kind of celebrating this. You can imagine a little casserole or some soup brought out and eaten out on the patio or something. This would just kind of, how you serve food in some cultures is very important. Americans tend to just eat fast food. In other cultures, they make a big deal out of eating, and a piece like this would just tend to enhance the meal, I would think. Servings, kind of a obscure sort of form that probably wouldn't readily be made, but These very long oval shapes, maybe a baking dish, perhaps serving fish or a salad or something. It would just kind of make the meal a little bit more fun to have these kind of shapes. We have a few teapots to show. Kind of a dark slide. But the tea ceremony, this is kind of more of an English tea. It's not Japanese or Oriental at all. It's an English tea. It would be, it's very formal, often very formal. It's a daily tradition and ritual for the English as well. I wish the Americans kind of had more of a tradition like this, and maybe they'll evolve to something like that. I would sure help the potters out a lot. Anyway, this just kind of wants you to grab a hold of this, and it just so very gracefully pours, directs the liquids out that spout, just kind of curves it out. I just can imagine the kind of a gesture of pouring this. And oftentimes it's that moment of pouring the tea from the teapot into the cup that just is a wonderful thing. It's, you know, Americans, it seems like we already have it in the cup. It's already there waiting. It's already in the styrofoam cup or whatever. But that moment of pouring the contents out of the teapot is a very wonderful moment. And we anticipate it, and it actually pours out. So this is a Tom Turner teapot. And this one, I've got one similar to this that I don't really like this kind of cannon sort of spout that comes off of it. It's sort of like a gun to me. He was in the service, military, and maybe this is something that kind of unconsciously comes out of that. It's just this big gun or rifle that comes out of these. I know it would pour in direct to a cup very far away almost. So some things to me, he's such a technician. This is featherweight. It's very, very light. Lightweight and made very refined in many ways. Personally, I'm just not as fond of that. I'm not terribly fond of this one either, Chris Staley, but it's another attempt of a teapot about teapots, and you can right away recognize that it has a spout and a handle and so it contains something and a lid you can kind of pick up. But it gets just a bit too bulgy. It almost looks like some innards or something. I'm not exactly sure what it's trying to look like. I want to try and make some sense out of it, but I'm not just sure. But it is kind of says a lot about our times. Where there's a lot of ambiguity, a lot of things we're not quite sure about. Technically, it's a very fine piece, but personally, I just, you don't have to like everything either. I've got a lot of pots I don't like, but I do enjoy them just because what they are, when they're being made. Here's a very beautiful Tom Coleman teapot, elaborately carved. And this relates very much back to the Celadon pieces of the Sung Dynasty, almost 1,000 years ago. Kind of this leafy quality would certainly enhance the flavor of the tea, I would imagine. And this is not a teapot, but it's a serving vessel of some sort. It's Victor Babu maybe made it, and just kind of a fun whimsical, maybe probably a wine ewer, and just the way the handle is kind of has that character just kind of might enhance the use of the piece. It's serious but not really serious. It probably would contain a fine wine and be used at an elegant garden party perhaps, or maybe not really used at all, but it does have a beautiful aesthetic. That it's formal, but yet it's kind of a little bit fun at the same time. So Linda Arbuckle, and exaggeration of parts, you certainly could hardly use this, but it's a teapot about a teapot, and it has this great, I'm a little teapot sort of nursery rhyme kind of quality about it. This spout just kind of goes way up and away and away from the piece. I like that. Very much the whimsical, playful quality that it has. Exaggerated parts sometimes makes very, very fun. Very small base, extremely tall knob on the lid. So this is like a craft sphere, and it's just another fun teapot and creamer and sugar. So it definitely functions. Probably doesn't pour very well, and you probably would never even use it, but it's a teapot about teapots. It does document our time, too, because thinking of 100 years from now, when we're no longer burning petroleum, this will be a very important historical piece. So
Toddler.
Some man I study with at the University of Iowa, Chuck Hines, and he has been very influenced by the Oriental kind of aesthetic. This resembles very much those Tama jars that showed one of the 16th century or 14th century Tama jar. That very natural, almost organic, almost not man-made object. It's still a teapot. You can recognize it right away. It has a lid, handle, spout. But a very natural gesture, almost like a tree limb going off of there. A couple of coffee mugs. The name of this one, Paul Dersang made this one. And it's just using the coffee mug as a vehicle for expression. I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to say here, but it's kind of fun to think of something as mundane as a coffee cup to be transformed in an art object like this. And you right away, you can see it's a coffee mug or a mug. It has that kind of handle shape. Some by Ron Nagel. And these, at first you go, oh, it's a coffee mug. You look at it and you go, wait, there's no handle. But somehow the shape, the size, these are only about 3 or 4 inches tall, is the shape of a coffee cup or some handheld drinking vessel. These I like to point out to you. It's become very famous. One of these cups might go for about $5,000 or $6,000. And so there is some value out of this little tiny bit of clay that you can transform into a very valuable art object. Some more. They're not very large, but the richness. Some of these are fired up to 20 times. He puts a little glaze on the fire. Puts a little more glaze on fires and builds up a very deep, rich, gem-like quality surface. This one just barely has a little handle coming off of it. Very important contemporary art objects, though. As small as they are, you don't have to make big things. You know, these are very tiny. Some I've seen some 2 and 3 inch tall pieces, 2 inch tall pieces. So small that you can barely see them, and they're going for $10,000. Incredible what's starting to happen. Here's a very mundane, not sort of seemingly mundane, very informal sort of cup. And coffee cups, especially, it's a form that you take to your mouth and your lips. And very few objects you do that to, maybe your toothbrush, I guess, or a fork. But a coffee cup, it becomes like an old friend after a while, that you just become very, you scrutinize it very closely as you look at it and hold it, and sometimes even the most common cup can become a very beautiful art object. Some plates, I got some plates I wanted to show. This is showing the material of clay, how it tears and cracks and stretches. Clay as it shrinks, cracks. Okay. 5 more minutes. You're getting there, just about there. The plate form, the traditional plate form as it's being used today. This is a Bernard Leach serving tray, and this sort of has a wheat. You can imagine maybe eating some bread off of this beautiful way that wheat kind of, a simple design kind of might instill that. See, I got a few more slides. If I want to try and get to the last slide, bear with me. I'm trying to speed through those. Some pieces by Dorothy Hefner. Very contemporary pieces of today. We see color is style. It seems that if it's colorful, it's in style. And she's taken this color and these kind of meaningless patterns, but patterns can instill different things, evoke different things for different people. So maybe it sort of looks like cloth or sorts of things. I can't imagine actually eating out of these things, but they're just beautiful objects in themselves. Although each piece is decorated quite differently, they all tend to relate very nicely. This looks like kind of a weaving or a rug or something. Beautiful sort of decoration. I showed this one yesterday, and these last ones are about vases. This one is called the Warrior Vase. I don't know if it would be called, I would probably call it a footed bowl, perhaps, but Again, a base form has been used for centuries or thousands of years as a form. I showed this one yesterday too, as a base, a Diplion base. Showing these, they've been used to decorate the outside surface. And for funerals, or this one's from a sporting athletic event where somebody has won the event. This is a Ming Dynasty vase, it's blue on white. Bud vase. This red kind of alarming kind of red color, very difficult copper red color to get. This is a bud vase. These vase, this vase, it just would hold a rose very, very beautifully. It just has this long neck and belly to hold. Like would do its job very, very well. I want to show some contemporary vases, using the vase as a vehicle for outside surface decoration. This piece kind of looks like a robin's egg or a bird's egg of some sort. It's just a beautiful object. It really would be difficult to use because it'd be so precarious, but beautiful sort of shape. The vase used to show special glaze effects. This is crystalline glaze, kind of a very recent glaze technique where special, sophisticated firing process will allow these zinc crystals to grow. Kind of return again to this crudeness and oriental aesthetic. Using the vase here, it kind of looks like a little person for you, with these little arms coming off the shoulder, little belly. I love this one's called the French Woman. It has a very wonderful humanistic form. Very graceful, and this cold kind of blue colors are very beautiful, but don't touch me. Vase by Paul Solder, this is kind of really abstracted decoration. It doesn't really mean much or say much, but it causes a lot of, evokes a lot of feelings and kind of ponder over. But this is kind of where pottery seems headed. Here by Hans Cooper, a very precarious tall vase. And maybe says something about our precariousness as human beings in the earth and in our environment. It's very beautiful, but it could easily be tipped over. Paul Solner, maybe this is about endangered species, perhaps. You know, what will some people think in the future? Some of these animals. This is by Rick Dillingham. It's actually a contemporary piece. It sort of looks like an artifact that's been put back together, but it's very intentional that he's made the piece, broken it apart, decorated the shards, and then reconstructed it. And so you have this kind of a spook on the whole idea of archaeology. A couple more slides. This is a beautiful vase by Lucy Ree, an English potter. Here, it's a beautiful humanistic sort of form, very, very elegant. And yet the glaze contrasts that very much, a greater sort of a crude glaze. The color of white is a color that's been very difficult to achieve throughout history, but now it's easy because of the materials we have. But the color white, in some cultures, the white might evoke snow or coldness, it might evoke a wedding, it might evoke the birth of a child. In Arab countries, the color white is the color of death, and they wear black at weddings and white at funerals, so different things for different cultures. Here's a vase shape. There's kind of a vase drawn on the shape. You have to kind of look at the decoration to see this kind of antiquated vase form, kind of an amphora shape. I wanted to show these. I'm not sure how these relate to function, but maybe in some way they do, but I did want to show these yesterday and didn't get a chance. So by Richard Shaw, and technically these are incredible pieces. They're all clay. He's made molds of each object here and then assembled it. Stand about 24 to 30 inches tall. And just exquisite the way these are. And maybe taking our functional objects and then transforming them into human sort of likeness of human beings. These are very important forms and very intriguing to me, painstakingly constructed.